to save others and think about others, it's not, we're not going to, you know, save the planet or the civilization on this planet. What definitely we need is to find solutions that preserve the planet within its boundaries. We believe there are two limits. There is a smaller limit, mm-hmm. which is related to the limit of what you provide individuals in a welfare state, you know, basic healthcare, food, shelter, and so on. And then there's the outer limit, which is how much we can use the natural resources. And many studies have shown that you can live within existing planetary resources in the same kind of quality of life, in the same kind of population that exists on the planet, and it would work. The problem is some individuals are taking much more than from other than others, and this is where the problem is. But it's also in relation to regulations by the government. To give an example, very concrete examples, just the subsidies that the fossil fuel industry receive, if they just remove that, it can tip the scales towards renewable energy. And we're not saying about making billions, not like trying to make the same companies make the same amount of money they're making right now. But what we mean is like the shift in what is good for the planet and the economy has to shift.
Sure, that's a very good point. I'm looking at the clock. We're really running short of time here. Let's move away from these big oil companies, Jody Grage, and look at other companies, other businesses. And this particular headline, which I'm going to forge into another piece of news or concept, I should say, came out in 2019, how 700 companies, which included companies like Facebook and Amazon, were accused of concealing their environmental impact. Basically, this leads to the whole notion of greenwashing, okay, where there's false pledges made towards how they are moving towards that in the way that their business products work. When you have this many companies of this stature that are basically lying about the fact that they're going green in one way or another, how can there be any hope then?
Well, it's pretty hard to see, all right, because the company's basic thrust is to make more money. So I think legislation and oversight has to do with it. I also think that people themselves and organizations can really look at the fact that too many people consuming too much stuff is not going to do it. There must be a better balance between of consumption and population. Climate change is, of course, affecting the poorest,
okay,
the most, and
right,
that isn't sustainable.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vatari and the team, it's goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Back to Reality, and thank you for joining us. So, I am Asma, your humble host. I am a student of English literature. And in here, I have with me two very dear guests, Zainab and Bita. Welcome.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's a really big pleasure for me to join you for this discussion. I am Bita, a medical student from Iran.
And assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm Zainab Sadat. I'm from Iran and I have my MINTFL teaching English as a foreign language. And it's my pleasure to be here today in this discussion.
Thank you very much, both of you. Thank you for joining us in today's episode. So, dear listeners, previously we talked about the need of having a religion and the need of applying all the rules of religion into our life, into different dimensions of our life. We talked about the fact that people in the past used to have a very primitive understanding of their religion. And as everything grows and development happens in different aspects of science and social, economical issues, people start to grow even in their understanding of religion. And what happens is that sometimes maybe they might have some kind of thought that is going to be exactly the opposite of what we right now think, what we right now around this table think about religion. Many people might think that religion is depressing. Religion is going to make us feel like dull, and it's not going to make us enjoy life in a
it simple... It confines you,
exactly. It's just like imprisonment. To put it very much precise, I would say it looks like imprisonment to some people. Now, what's your idea upon this fact that religion is not going to depress you? Religion is not going to make you feel like you're not enjoying your life.
You know, first I'm going to start with the root of why people feel this depression, you know, upon themselves for religion. The thing is, most of the people just forget the presence of God, and this ignorance make them feel like, okay, this is a guideline that will rule me in this life, and I cannot choose what to do. I'm not the one who is choosing. This is religion that will lead me. And this feeling of, you know, being limited makes them feel depressed.
Exactly, Bita. Feeling limited.
Exactly.
That's the point.
But the thing is, you have to try to understand that religion is not limitation.
And how? How would you say that?
Even religion has two parts, materialistic parts and spiritual parts. And when you are just ignoring the spiritual part and the bond with God, you will, you know, face this depression. For, you know, just avoiding this situation, you have to strengthen your bond with God. And I think this is the only solution that will answer these problems for all the people around the world. Because there is a deep need in ourselves to just have someone always when you are alone, when you feel sad, when you are depressed, to rely on.
Yeah.
And who is better than God? And, you know, even in our religion, we have it as, you know, like something like taqwa, even tawakkul, and something
which
like
that. Which is self-control.
Exactly. And these are the things that will help you to overcome the feeling of depression in this road.
Yeah.
I don't say that being a religious person, being someone who is, you know, who have a strong belief in religion is something really easy. No, at all. It is difficult at the same time that it is, you know, somehow sweet, but at the same time difficult.
Yeah, it will inspire you, but at the very same time, it's going to be a very difficult journey.
Exactly. So first of all, you have to understand and accept this point.
Yeah.
That is difficult to be human.
So you just said that, according to what you said, limitation is the thing that makes people scared of religion, that makes them feel that, because, you know, in many groups and gatherings, I've seen it that when they see you, as it is very much clear from your appearance, if you are following a special rules or if you are considering your religion in different aspects of your life, it might be very much clear from your appearance. People would tell you like, okay, now that you are going by your religion and all the rules are just applied into your life, you are the one who is not going to enjoy life. I'm not going to be like you because religion is actually the thing that is not, you know what I mean? I mean, it's not going to help you enjoy life more and more.
Some kind of a superficial point of view of discerning religion as something that brings you limitations.
But you know, you agree with me that many people, when they see
yes,
you, that you are religious.
Yes, lots of people have this, that idea, unfortunately. But as I said, it's a superficial point of view, I guess. Because, for example, I'm using this example that about fasting. when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala asks us to stop eating for one day, you know, our nature as human beings is it makes us eat. And we enjoy eating.
That's, so we naturally enjoy eating.
That's something that cannot be denied. Yeah. But we might find it difficult, bothering, and we might not feel okay
as
with not eating.
As we are all the time, as comfortable as we are.
But when you go in depth, when you go into the philosophy of fasting, you find lots of things. As I said,
happiness fasting, and bliss.
Yes, fasting is just one simple example. You will feel...
when you even do your praying.
You will empathy with the poor. You will try how to be more patient.
Yeah, and since we are just in the time that many people are going for the Advent pilgrimage, then I would say that even that is very much difficult.
Yes, and that's
there
a lesson.
There are plenty much of difficulties in the way, but still many people would go for it, and they're not depressed.
And they
throughout
learn
the way
lots of things from Arbaim Meshaya. Yes, they learn lots of things. So the superficial view is doing something difficult. Why should we go, for example, as you said, Meshaya? Why should we go in a way in that heat, in that difficult situation?
For a person who does not believe in what the people who are going for this pilgrimage...
It might even seem silly. But, you know, I said, in depth, there are lots of lessons and lots of positive points.
And love, of course, you know. Religion, I personally believe that religion is based on love. Even when you are applying the rules of Allah into your life, it means that... you are just showing your love to Allah.
Yes,
it is a manifestation of your love. When you love someone, you have to do something for them. You have to show it in order to gain that love from that person.
And you know, all the human beings, with no exception, do lots of things and they go through lots of difficult situations for different things. But they do not admit that. And when it comes to religion, it becomes something irrational. But the fact is that we are all doing difficult things because of our mothers, our beloved ones, our children, our friends, and lots of the group of people. But the religious people do all these difficulties for the sake of Allah. And in its nature, it's somehow the same. And that's
exactly,
in fact, my idea about this.
Yeah, thank you, Zainab. And now let's go for a short break before I ask Bida's idea upon this thing that we're talking about. And then we'll be back. Thank you, dear listeners.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Well, dear listeners, welcome back. We are here in Back to Reality. We are discussing religion and how we must to apply that in different aspects of our life. We talked about the very fact that religion is not depressing. And we said that religion is supposed to make you happy, because when you are applying the rules of Allah into your life, you must feel that satisfaction of a person who is loving another person. So now, Bita, I have seen many people, for example, when they see a little girl, since you know that girls have to apply to rules at a very younger age. And when many people see them, that they are going through fasting or, for example, praying or, for example, wearing hijab, they would accuse their parent for, why do you do this to your children? Oh, they are so poor little girl. And why are you going to draw them into this thing? Why do you drag them into this thing? Have you ever seen such incidents?
Exactly. I've seen this scenario and this scene.
This debate and negotiation.
More than what you think. More than what you think. Even about my sister, because my sister is 10 years old.
So she's new to the club.
Exactly. And, you know, always there are someone who's telling us, oh, come on, why are you making a job at this age? It's not that much necessary. You know, we're not talking about the... you know, necessity right now. And the thing is, these kind of people that accuse other people for doing the right thing at the right age are the one who see a kind of position between life and joy and joy, you know, joy, life and religion. Mm-hmm. They think like if you are a religious person, you won't enjoy anything.
Uh-huh, so you mean that they feel there is a separation between religion and your personal life. So if you're religious, you're not going to enjoy life. Mm-hmm. That's exactly the same thing as I told you.
The thing is, as my dear sister Zainab told us, you know, there are some people who just see the beauty of religion. Mm-hmm. But you cannot just convince all of the people around the world that religion is something that should be in your life.
Exactly.
You cannot just
force
someone and force someone to do something.
Yeah.
But when you see someone that is willing to, you know, acting as the guidelines of, for example, his or her own religion, you cannot just accuse her or him. You know, I'm really against that, you know, bad behavior, really. When I see people, as you told me, that tells other people, why are you doing, you know, this? We are, for example, here in a foreign country, why are we making hijab? You know, you don't consider the point that we are seeing God everywhere.
Exactly.
God is everywhere. No matter where you are, no matter you're in Iran, you're in an Islamic country or in a European country, you are Muslim, you have your own beliefs. And this is about the God, the presence of God.
Exactly.
Nothing else.
Yeah.
And also the thing is, this is about the passion you have for mm-hmm. God. And you know, at the end, I want to tell you as a gist of our speaking.
Exactly.
You have to strengthen your bond with God. This is the only solution, this is the only answer, and this is the only way.
Mm-hmm. We see that in the narrations and also in the words of many scholars, we see that they talk about melting in the name of Allah. So if you come to that point in which you consider Allah in different step of your life, then it's not going to be something very much difficult. Then you would do it with love and satisfaction. It's not going to be a drudgery. It's no longer going to look like imprisonment, entanglement. Mm-hmm. It's going to be pretty much easier. I know that it might have some very much difficult appearance, because when people see you that you're wearing hijab, that seems naturally difficult. But when you do it for a greater cause, for a bigger goal, then it would sound pretty much easier to you as a person who is practicing the rules of Allah. So in today's episode, we were talking about religion. We talked about the controversial debate that many people believe religion is going to add limits into your life. You are going to be limited and you're not going to enjoy your life. But the truth is that it depends on the way you look at your religion. It depends on the bond you have created with your Lord. It depends on your spiritual journey, how much you work on it, how much you would love to grow throughout this journey. So as we talked, I guess we made it pretty much clear that religion is not imprisonment. Religion is not limitation. On the contrary, it's a way that is going to help you spread and grow bigger and bigger, because we have seen it as example of whatever that we're saying right now are the greater scholars that we have in our religion. We have greater scholars that they have accomplished so much, and at the same time, they were true obedient of Allah. So, dear listeners, thank you for staying with us. Until another time, I bid you farewell.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The
Around the World with Reporters.
Italy is bracing itself for fresh elections on September 25 after the government of national unity led by Mario Draghi collapsed at the end of July. The former president of the European Central Bank and Goldman Sachs managing director Draghi had lost support of the once anti-establishment five-star movement, the League and Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia. These three parties failed to back him in a confidence vote on his leadership, triggering a government crisis that ended with President Sergio Mattarella calling for snap elections. This will be the first time the Italians go to the polls in September in the country's Republican history.
There is a strong disaffection with politics in Italy, but while in the elections held 5 years ago, the five-star movement was able to intercept people's anger and dissatisfaction. This time, there doesn't seem to be a party strong enough to do the same.
According to final polls, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. Its leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, could be Italy's next prime minister, the Italian media have reported. Her party took around 4% of votes in the last election in 2018.
I don't have faith in establishment politics, but I don't know who to vote for. At the same time, I think not voting could be even worse. I'm really undecided.
The truth is that I don't have much trust in politicians. Will they be able to keep their electoral pledges?
A few days ago, the US government warned that Russian cash had been funneled to Italian parties sympathetic to the Kremlin without specifying which groups had been the recipients of the funds. Some analysts have seen the US move as a warning to those parties which had expressed sympathy for Russian President Vladimir Putin over the past years.
I think the cabinet secretary with the security brief has already made clear that no Italian politicians nor political parties have received funding from Moscow. If Russia has meddled in elections held in foreign countries, it goes without saying the US certainly did the same.
Over 51 million Italians are entitled to vote at the weekend. Sunday's elections will be held amid general disaffection and political discredit. Recent surveys have shown that some 35% of the Italians won't show up at the polls, a trend that, if confirmed, could put turnout at a record low. Max Civili, Rome.
Tensions between British Hindus and Muslims have escalated recently, with the unrest mostly involving young men from both communities and leading to scuffles and assaults. On Tuesday, hundreds of masked Muslim men descended on a Hindu temple in Birmingham. Local Muslims were furious over a recent attempt by the temple to platform a hardline Indian preacher.
Things are a bit tasty here, but ultimately the reason that they've gathered in these numbers is because this centre was planning to platform a very notorious BJP representative who espouses the Hindutva fascist ideology, which is very prominent in India right now and is responsible for a lot of anti-Muslim hate crimes which have taken place there. That ideology has essentially been exported now, unfortunately, into the streets of Britain, and it's been leading up to the point over months.
Tuesday's unrest was sparked following a Hindu mob marching through Muslim-majority areas in the nearby city of Leicester on Saturday, chanting Hindutva slogans. Eyewitnesses say the marchers attacked local Muslim businesses and intimidated the community. Local police failed to stop the rally, which was later confronted by a crowd of Muslims. According to some reports, the violence flared up after a recent Asia Cup cricket match between arch-rivals India and Pakistan. However, Muslims in Leicester have been routinely targeted by Hindu thugs way before the match.
And they think they can do the same thing here what they can do in India. We've lived with Hindus for decades, never had any issues with them whatsoever until these guys came along. These young men came along. And they've caused so much grief here. And the most Muslims here are very peaceful. They've turned the other cheek for so long, turned the other cheek, called the police. Police haven't done anything. Their inaction has caused this. So I blame the police for this.
As UK police scramble to investigate many incidents, the feud has gone global, as India and Pakistan's high commissions issued passionate statements condemning either side of the divide, fading any hopes of a quick solution to the chaos. Robert Carter, Leicester.
Lula has returned to the southern region of Brazil holding massive back-to-back campaign rallies with reinforced security. It was in this region that in 2018, Lula suffered an armed attack on his caravan, the same year he was imprisoned for 580 days in Curitiba. Workers' Party President Gleisi Hoffmann became emotional, reflecting back on the year when Lula was jailed in a move to bar his candidacy.
Esse é o seu retorno a Curitiba, presidente Lula, no braço do povo.
This is your return to Curitiba, President Lula, in the arms of the people. It is redemption. It is the victory of our struggle over 580 days of injustice and over your persecution.
Polls show that the region continues to be a stronghold for Jair Bolsonaro. However, the incumbent faces fierce opposition, mainly as a result of what is perceived as Bolsonaro's failed policies.
O pior problema é que a fome voltou, né?
The worst problem is that hunger is back. You have more than 30 million people suffering from hunger. All the political and public advances that were made for the people are being taken away. People are not able to retire anymore. They want to starve people to death.
Our country needs to rebuild its democracy, rebuild its nation, its unity, and its political democracy by respecting its diverse institutions. With the current government, our country became a worldwide mockery, a joke worldwide. It became a country disregarded by the main international political alliances.
Now, with just 2 weeks remaining, the slogan out here is Lula in just one round. Camila Escalante in Curitiba.
Syria's Ministry of Information organized an event to pay tribute to journalists who were killed while covering the war on the country. Syrian officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, technicians, and other workers in the media sector.
The martyrs of media are the true heroes on battlefields alongside the Syrian Arab army. They will remain alive in our memory. Meeting their families is a great honor because they represent truly an example of strength and loyalty to the homeland. We are honoring them today to thank them for their great sacrifices.
Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation expressing to Press TV how proud they are that their family members' blood was one of the main reasons for Syria's victory over terrorism.
This event means a lot to me. When I receive a call on an honoring, I feel that my son is still remembered and even still around. This homeland requires us to sacrifice. Without sacrifice, we would have no future.
My son was a war correspondent. He was martyred near Kenitra. He was my only son. He sacrificed his blood for the country. The enemy and its media outlets were strong and working to weaken Syria, but thanks to the sacrifices of Syrians, we triumphed.
Press TV's correspondent Maya Nasser was also among the list of journalists who lost their lives during the Syrian conflict. He was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He is one of many journalists who was keen on always being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. Despite knowing the dangers of reporting on battlefields, many journalists risked their lives to report on the truth of events. Tens were killed or injured, defending the principles of journalism and showing responsibility in conveying what was truly happening on the ground in the face of a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
The 77th United Nations General Assembly has opened, with the UN Secretary General warning of a winter of discontent, as many Western nations are economically reeling from the backfiring of their sanctions on Russia. Iranian President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi will give his first address to the UN on September 21st, with a focus on creating a more just world through economic multilateralism. Raisi met with French President Emmanuel Macron and top leaders of the European Union, but amid what Iranian delegates described as a very tense atmosphere. France and the other Western signatories have failed for years to adhere to the 2015 Landmark Agreement, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Raisi told Macron that Europe needs to show that its foreign policies are guided by the sovereign interests of their citizens and actually separate from the demands of Washington. This week, Raisi will hold bilateral meetings with the heads of Iraq, Pakistan, Japan, and more than a half dozen other nations, as well as with representatives of a large Iranian-American community, a group estimated to be well over 2 million people. Raisi stressed that Iran is willing to reach a, quote, fair and stable agreement to revive the 2015 deal, but that Iran needs to receive reassuring guarantees that the U.S. will not withdraw from the accord, as it did in May 2018. Ramin Mazahiri, New York City.
Free pigeons for a world free of war. Iran's War University hosted the director of the United Nations Information Center in Iran, Inger Marie Veniz, along with military attachés from different embassies, to attend this ceremony dubbed the Book of Peace and Defense, which is themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. The UNIC head read out a statement from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the event.
A time to observe 24 hours of non-violence and ceasefire, we renew our call for all people to do more than lay down their weapons.
This event comes on the occasion of the National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, the longest armed conflict of the 20th century, which was waged by the then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and heavily funded by the West. Every year on the occasion, the Islamic Republic holds nationwide ceremonies to highlight its resistance against the Iraqi forces.
At that time, the Ba'athist regime, and on top of it, Saddam Hussein, was fully supported by numerous Western countries. The war continued for 8 years, but we fought the invaders and did not give an inch of our soil to them. So today, we as veterans feel bound to transfer our expertise and tactics to the new generation to preserve our defense might.
Saddam Hussein failed to make any achievement in his war against Iran, but the humanitarian effects of the offensive are still lingering in Iran, with many war veterans continuing to reel from exposure to chemical substances used by Iraqi forces. Those chemical materials were reportedly supplied by a number of German, French, and Dutch corporations.
The Islamic Republic takes great pride in how it defended the country during the Iraqi imposed war, calling it the sacred defense and a drive for its present self-sufficiency in the military sector. Meanwhile, Tehran holds this annual commemoration ceremony as a chance to promote peace and shed light on the dark consequences of war. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Amid international calls for renewing the UN brokered truce, the Yemeni Center for Human Rights has held a press conference in Sana'a to release a report titled The Alleged Truce. The report highlights the Saudi-led coalition's violations of the UN agreement since it was brokered in April.
Saudi Arabia's violations were committed from the first day of the war, but they continued even under the UN truce. The most important violations were the non-compliance with the terms of the truce, which included reducing the number of scheduled flights and specifying only one destination instead of two, as well as the continued detention of fuel ships. There is a breach on the essence of the agreement.
The report says the Saudi-led coalition has committed over 14,000 violations, including waging 278 airstrikes, which led to the death of Yemeni civilians.
As a human rights center, we affirm that the most important violations are the loss of life. Unfortunately, during the truce, 70 Yemeni civilians, including women and children, were killed. The siege has also continued during the truce. This has caused the deaths of thousands of civilians due to the lack of fuel in hospitals.
Recently, the UN Security Council urged warring sites in Yemen to extend the truce, saying it has had tangible benefits for the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. So far, there are no signs of agreement from both parties.
A complete end to the war and siege is what Yemenis are demanding from the international community, including the United Nations. They say that temporary truce should not be extended since the world body has failed to ensure its full implementation. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
British police have found themselves embroiled in another racism scandal, this time surrounding the killing of an unarmed black man in South London by armed officers on the 5th of September. Following an alleged police pursuit, 24-year-old Chris Carver was behind the wheel of a car hemmed in by two police vehicles in a narrow street before one round was fired, ending his life. He leaves behind a fiancée and an unborn child. No gun was found in the car.
Thousands of protesters have descended outside police headquarters in central London to vent their fury over what they say is gross injustice being carried out by the authorities against Chris and his family. Accusations are swirling around, some of which include that the police who stopped Chris on that fateful day may have known who was inside the car in the lead-up to the fatal shooting. This is, of course, all being investigated, but the protest organisers have made absolutely clear that they are going to refuse to back down until the demands of the family are met and justice be served.
Fighting back the tears, family members spoke of their ordeal after seeing the body for the first time since the killing. News of the shooting has caused uproar, especially in the black community. They feel this was just another example of a racist system out to harm them. Following the backlash, the officer responsible for the shooting has been suspended. An investigation is also underway, but the police watchdog warned it could take 9 months to reach a conclusion. The family expressed anger at the lengthy wait. However, the question of race playing a role will be examined as a factor, providing some small hope that the family's demands will be answered. Robert Carter, London.
Palestinian protesters took to the streets in the blockaded Gaza Strip following the Friday prayers to condemn Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied city of Al-Quds. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime, vowing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The protest comes following the desecration of the mosque by Israeli settlers backed by Israeli forces. The mosque is the third holiest site in Islam. Hamas resistance movement has warned the Israeli regime against violating the sanctity of Al-Quds.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line that mustn't be crossed. We hold the Zionist entity fully responsible for any attack in Al-Quds. The enemy will only open the gates of hell on itself. The continuation of attacks on the sanctity of Al-Quds will backfire on the Zionist entity and its settlers.
Israeli settlers regularly storm Al-Aqsa Mosque, a provocative move that infuriates Palestinians. The attacks and desecration of the mosque compound increased during Jewish holidays.
We salute our people in Al-Quds and we say to them that Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza will not remain silent amid Israeli attacks on Al-Quds. We also call on all Palestinians and Muslims to mobilize to confront Israel's conspiracies against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians have raised the alarm over Tel Aviv's plots to divide Al-Aqsa Mosque into Jewish and Muslim sections or sitting times for visits.
The Zionists have no right to be in Al-Aqsa Mosque because it's purely for Muslims since ancient times. They are trying to control Al-Aqsa Mosque, but all their attempts will be in vain.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to step up their support for Al-Quds until the end of all the Israeli violations in the Holy City. Observers say the world has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds while turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against the oppressed people of Palestine for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The vast consequences of Hurricane Fiona shows that Puerto Rico is still hampered by U.S. colonial control. People are showing resilience in the face of Hurricane Fiona in Puerto Rico, where the power grid crashed across the entire island due to the storm. Many who learned from 2017 Hurricane Maria are dipping into their personal water reserves and using power generators. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. This is the first part. According to Associated Press, Hurricane Fiona struck Puerto Rico's southwest coast recently as it unleashed landslides, knocked the power grid out, and ripped up asphalt from roads and flung the pieces around. Hundreds of people were evacuated or rescued across the island as floodwaters rose swiftly. Rushing rivers of brown water enveloped cars, first floors, and even an airport runway in the island's southern region. Forecasters said the storm threatened to dump historic levels of rain, with up to 30 inches, 76 centimeters, possible in eastern and southern Puerto Rico. Governor Pedro Pierluisi said the damages that we are seeing are catastrophic. The storm washed away a bridge in the central mountain town of Utado that police say was installed by the National Guard after Hurricane Maria hit in 2017. Large landslides also were reported, with water rushing down big slabs of broken asphalt and into gullies. Fiona was centered 45 miles, about 75 kilometers south to southeast of Punta Cana, Dominican Republic, with maximum sustained winds of 85 meters per hour, according to the U.S. National Hurricane Center. It was moving to the west-northwest at 10 meters per hour. Fiona struck on the anniversary of Hurricane Hugo, which hit Puerto Rico 33 years ago as a Category 3 storm. The storm's clouds covered the entire island, and tropical storm force winds extended as far as 140 miles, 220 kilometers from Fiona Center. Joe Biden declared a state of emergency in U.S. territory as the eyes of the storm approached the island's southwest corner. LUMA, the company that operates power transmission and distribution, said bad weather, including winds of 80 meters per hour, had disrupted transmission lines, leading to a blackout on all the island. Current weather conditions are extremely dangerous and are hindering the capacity to evaluate the complete situation, it said, adding that it could take several days to fully restore power. Health centers were running on generators, and some of those had failed. Health Secretary Carlos Mellado said crews rushed to repair generators at the comprehensive center where several patients had to be evacuated. Fiona hit just 2 days before the anniversary of Hurricane Maria, a devastating Category 4 storm that struck on September 20, 2017, destroying the island's power grid and causing nearly 3,000 deaths. More than 3,000 homes still have only a blue tarp as a roof, and infrastructure remains very weak, including the power grid. Outages remain common, and reconstruction started only recently. And CBC reported Hurricane Fiona roared over the Dominican Republic, A day after knocking out power to all of Puerto Rico and causing damage the governor described as catastrophic. Many people were also left without water service. The blow from Fiona was made more devastating because Puerto Rico has yet to recover from Hurricane Maria, which killed nearly 3,000 people and destroyed the power grid in 2017. 5 years later, more than 3,000 homes on the island still have blue tarps for roofs. The wind and water from Fiona stripped the pavement from roads, tore off roofs, and sent torrents pouring into homes. The storm also took out a bridge and flooded two airports. Authorities reported two deaths from the hurricane, a Puerto Rican man who was swept away by a flooded river, and a person in the Dominican Republic who was hit by a falling tree. The storm was still expected to dump up to 38 centimeters of rain in some places as it spun away from the U.S. territory that is home to 3.2 million people. Forecasts call for the storm to grow into a major hurricane of Category 3 or greater and said it was on a path expected to pass close to Turks and Seychelles Islands and was not likely to threaten the U.S. mainland. According to CBC, one death was also associated with a blackout in Puerto Rico. A 70-year-old man who was burned to death after he tried to fill his generator with gasoline while it was running, officials said. Governor Pedro Pierluisi declined to say how long it would take to fully restore electricity, but he said for most customers in Puerto Rico, it would be a question of days. Fiona previously battered the Eastern Caribbean, killing one man in the French territory of Guadeloupe when floodwaters washed his home away, officials said. The system hit Puerto Rico on the anniversary of Hurricane Hugo, which slammed into the island in 1989 as a Category 3 storm.
Seven barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. Islam is a religion, and as we say, it is a complete religion. One of the explanations of this being a complete religion is that Islam has certain protocols and principles for every aspect of human life. And one of the most important factors or one of the most important acts that a human, that is mankind, me, you, take part in is the practice of learning, of gaining knowledge, of educating ourselves. Now, obviously, this concept needs to be discussed. There's a lot of different opinions and so on and so forth. But obviously, the greatest of knowledge is the knowledge of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Getting to know Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, His attributes, how those attributes reflect on this particular plane of existence, the planes of existence, how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala manifests Himself through those planes of existence, and so on and so forth. But how do you learn these particular principles? How do you sit in a classroom where a person is speaking about such great knowledge? Because now obviously this knowledge is, you know, of a high caliber. Therefore there are certain etiquettes that must be followed, not only by the student, but by the teacher.
So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear brothers and sisters today, our dear listeners, is a book that is actually a book that has been taught as a textbook in many of the Islamic seminaries throughout the world. In many languages it has been translated, and obviously that we will be introducing one of the English translations of this particular book to our dear listeners in our next segment. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So as we mentioned in our previous segment, there is a particular book that deals with the etiquettes of learning. Now, the original title of this book is known as Munyatul Murid, which obviously is a book that was written in Arabic. As we know, majority of the Islamic books that we have, and it was a book written a very long time ago, and hopefully we will try and, if time permits, speak about the author of this book. So the book then was translated into Persian, and then obviously then into English, and many other languages as well. So one of the English translations, I say that because there is another translation, is titled Science, Teaching and Learning in Islam. The author of the original book is Shahid Thani, the second martyr, when we will speak about him a bit. The book was translated by Gail Mahjuba Babst, and again was published by Ansarian Publications in the holy city of Qum, Iran, in the year 2013 for the first time. Now, as mentioned, this book goes through the etiquettes of a student, how a student should conduct himself within a classroom environment, how a student should partake in learning, how a student should interact with his fellow students, how a student should interact with the knowledge and with the teacher. But that's not all. It also, you know, first of all, speaks about the importance of learning. It speaks about the necessity of learning. And what is good about this book and what is important about this book is that it brings about certain traditions that you will not find in any other book. The reason for this is because Shaykh Thani had access to certain books that those books are not available to us anymore. But alhamdulillah, we have this book in our hands that is extant, and it assists in that regard. And then obviously the book not only deals with the student but also the teacher, that the teacher has certain etiquettes. So the rights of the student on the teacher and the rights of the teacher upon the student both are discussed in this wonderful book. Now Shahid Thani, very quickly, obviously was a great scholar. One of his other books that is studied in the Islamic seminary that has always been studied since the time of its coming into existence, since the time that Shahid wrote it, is a book called Shar' al-Lum'ah. Lum'ah is a book that was written by Shahid Awal, the first Shahid, the first martyr. Shahid Thani wrote glosses and a commentary on this book. And it is this commentary that is studied within the Islamic seminaries within the subject of jurisprudence. It is one of the first textbooks that any student of Islam will study with regards to jurisprudence. So this is Shahid Thani. The reason he was executed was because there was false information given to one of the kings, and unfortunately the Shahid was executed by the king. He was decapitated, beheaded, and it is said that his body was thrown into the ocean. Unfortunately, what was said about him was untrue, but history says otherwise, that this is what happened to the great scholar of Islam. So anyway, we will be reading a portion of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners in our next segment. So please stay tuned.
Sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past, but where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. The book that we introduced to our listeners in our previous segment was titled Science, Teaching and Learning in Islam, which is an English translation of the originally Arabic written book, Munyatul Murid, which is a book that is studied at the very beginning of a student's journey within the Islamic sciences. And again, it was written by the great scholar Shahid Thani. So one of the chapters in the book that is a very important chapter that he deals with is that how do you keep what you have learned pure? And obviously that particular being that will come and kind of, you know, dent or make it what you know impure is the devil, is the Satan. Obviously with his tricks, he will try and manipulate you, try and, you know, take the purity out of what you know, and the knowledge that you have attained. So one of the particular headings of this book is how to stay out of reach from the tricks of Satan. If someone feels this painful, lethal mental state has come upon him, he must arise to cure himself. He needs to ask for help from those with the religious insight in order to heal himself from such a spiritual illness. However, if after struggling he is unable to find someone with this religious insight, he must refer to the written works in order to find the needed cure. In the event that he is not able to find a person with religious insight or the written works, and only hears of the name of such a person and his works, it is at this point that he must take refuge with God and seek his help. If one feels he doesn't have the ability or capacity to receive this favor from God, and he is forced to be alone, he must choose seclusion and being unknown in this situation. Rather than coming forward to answer people's questions, when people do refer to him with their questions, he must refrain from answering until he has gained a condition of worthiness and is able to become involved in education. So we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us the ability to firstly recognize those tricks and to then to remove them from us or to protect ourselves from them. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.